her, but we hadn't said much. She understood that I needed to process things and had simply been there for me, not pushing me on things I didn't want to talk about, even though there were a dozen things she wanted to ask. The Academy's dead had been honored in one group memorial service, although their families had made arrangements for each person's respective funeral. I'd gone to the larger service. The chapel had been packed, with standing room only. Father Andrew had read the names of the dead, listing Dimitri and Molly among them. No one was talking about what had really happened to them. There was too much other grief anyway. We were drowning in it. No one even knew how the Academy would pick up the pieces and start running again.
"You look worse than I do," I told Adrian.
I didn't think that was possible. He brought the bottle to his lips and took a long drink.
"Nah, you always look good. As for me, well, it's hard to explain. The auras are getting to me. There's so much sorrow around here. You can't even begin to understand. It radiates from everyone on a spiritual level. It's overwhelming. It makes your dark aura downright cheerful."
"Is that why you're drinking?"
"Yup. It shut my aura vision right off, thankfully, so I can't give you a report today."
He offered me the bottle, and I shook my head. He shrugged and took another drink.
"So, what can I do for you, Rose? I have a feeling you aren't here to check on me."
He was right, and I only felt a little bad about what I was here for. I'd done a lot of thinking this last week. Processing my grief for Mason had been hard. In fact, I hadn't even really quite resolved it when the ghost business had started. Now I had to mourn all over again. After all, more than Dimitri had been lost. Teachers had died, guardians and Maroy alike. None of my close friends had died, but people I knew from classes had. They'd been students at the Academy as long as I had, and it was weird to think I'd never see them again. That was a lot of loss to deal with, a lot of people to say goodbye to. But Dimitri, he was a different case. After all, how did you say goodbye to someone who wasn't exactly gone? That was the problem. "I need money," I told Adrian, not bothering with pretense. He arched an eyebrow.
"Unexpected, from you at least. I get that kind of request a lot from others. Pray tell, what would I be funding?"
I glanced away from him, focusing on the television. It was a commercial for some kind of deodorant. "I'm leaving the Academy," I said, finally.
"Also unexpected. You're only a few months out from graduation."
I met his eyes. "It doesn't matter. I have things to do now."
"I never figured you'd be one of the dropout guardians. You going to join the blood whores?"
"No," I said. "Of course not."
"Don't act so offended. That's not an unreasonable assumption. If you're not going to be a guardian, what else are you going to do?"
"I told you, I have things I have to take care of." He arched an eyebrow.
"Things that are going to get you into trouble?"
I shrugged. He laughed.
"Stupid question, huh? Everything you do gets you in trouble."
He propped his elbow up on the couch's arm and rested his chin in his hand.
"Why'd you come to me for money?"
"Because you have it." This also made him laugh.
"And why do you think I'll give it to you?"
I didn't say anything. I just looked at him, forcing as much womanly charm as I could into my expression. His smile went away, and his green eyes narrowed in frustration. He jerked his gaze away.
"Damn it, Rose, don't do that. Not now. You're playing on how I feel about you. It's not fair."
He gulped more vodka. He was right. I'd come to him because I thought I could use his crush to get what I wanted. It was low, but I had no choice. Getting up, I moved over and sat beside him. I held his hand. "Please, Adrian," I said. "Please help me. You're the only one I can go to."
"That's not fair," he repeated, slurring his words a little. "You're using those come-hither eyes on me, but it's not me you want. It's never been me. It's always been Belikov, and God only knows what you'll do now that he's gone.
He was right about that, too. Will you help me? I asked, still playing up the charisma. You're the only one I could talk to. The only one who really understands me.
Are you coming back? He countered.
Eventually. Tipping his head back, he exhaled a heavy breath. His hair, which I'd always thought looked stylishly messy, simply looked messy today.
Maybe it's for the best if you leave. Maybe you'll get over him faster if you go away for a while. Wouldn't hurt to be away from Lys's aura either. It might slow yours from darkening. Stop this rage you always seem to be in. You need to be happier and stop seeing ghosts.
My seduction faltered for a moment. Lyssa isn't why I'm seeing ghosts. Well, she is, but not in the way you think. I see the ghosts because I'm shadow-kissed. I'm tied to the world of the dead, and the more I kill, the stronger that connection becomes. It's why I see the dead and why I feel weird when Strigoi are near. I can sense them now. They're tied to that world, too. He frowned.
You're saying the auras mean nothing? That you aren't taking away the effects of spirit?
No, that's happening too. That's why this has all been so confusing. I thought there was just one thing going on, but there have been two. I see the ghosts because of being shadow-kissed. I'm getting upset and angry, bad even, because I'm taking away Lys's dark side. That's why my aura's darkening, why I'm getting so enraged lately. Right now, it just sort of plays out as a really bad temper. I frowned, thinking of the night Dimitri had stopped me from going after Jesse. But I don't know what it'll turn into next. Adrian sighed.
Why is everything so complicated with you?
Will you help me? Please, Adrian.
I ran my fingers along his hand.
Please help me.
Low.
Low.
This was so low of me, but it didn't matter. Only Dimitri did.
Finally, Adrian looked back at me. For the first time ever, he looked vulnerable.
When you come back, will you give me a fair shot?
I hid my surprise. What do you mean?
It's like I said. You've never wanted me. Never even considered me. The flowers, the flirting, it rolled right off you. You were so gone for him, and nobody noticed. If you go do your thing, will you take me seriously? Will you give me a chance when you return?
I stared. I definitely hadn't expected this. My initial instinct was to say no, that I could never love anybody again, that my heart had been shattered along with that piece of my soul that Dimitri held. But Adrian was looking at me so earnestly, and there was none of his joking nature. He meant what he said, and I realized all the affection for me he'd always teased about hadn't been a joke either. Lyssa had been right about his feelings.
Will you?
He repeated. God only knows what you'll do now that he's gone.
Of course.
Not an honest answer, but a necessary one. Adrian looked away and drank more vodka. There wasn't much left.
When are you leaving?
Tomorrow. Setting the bottle down, he stood up and walked off into the bedroom. He returned with a large stack of cash. I wondered if he kept it under his bed or something. He handed it to me wordlessly, and then picked up the phone and made some calls. The sun was up, and the human world, which handled most Moroi money, was also up and awake. I tried to watch TV while he talked, but I couldn't concentrate. I kept wanting to scratch the back of my neck. Because there was no way of knowing exactly how many Strigoi I and the others had killed, we'd all been given a different kind of tattoo instead of the usual set of Molnia marks. I'd forgotten its name, but this tattoo looked like a little star. It meant that the bearer had been in a battle and killed many Strigoi. When he finally finished his calls, Adrian handed me a piece of paper. It had the name and address of a bank in Missoula.
Go there, he said. I'm guessing you have to go to Missoula first anyway, if you're actually going on to anywhere civilized. There's an account set up for you with a lot of money in it. Talk to them, and they'll finish the paperwork with you.
I stood up and stuffed the bills in my jacket.
Thank you, I said.
Without hesitating, I reached out and hugged him. The scent of vodka was overpowering, but I felt I owed him. I was taking advantage of his feelings for me in order to further my own devices. He put his arms around me and held me for several seconds before letting go. I brushed my lips against his cheek as we broke apart, and I thought he might stop breathing.
I won't forget this, I murmured in his ear.
I don't suppose you'll tell me where you're going, he asked.
No, I said. I'm sorry.
Just keep your promise and come back.
I didn't actually use the word promise, I pointed out.
He smiled and pressed a kiss to my forehead.
You're right.
I'm going to miss you, little Dampier. Be careful. If you ever need anything, let me know. I'll be waiting for you.
I thanked him again and left, not bothering to tell him he might be waiting a long time. There was a very real possibility that I might not be coming back. The next day, I got up early, long before most of campus was awake. I'd hardly slept. I slung a bag over my shoulder and walked over to the main office in the administrative building. The office wasn't opened yet either, so I sat down on the floor in the hallway outside of it, studying my hands as I waited. I noticed two tiny flecks of gold on my thumbnail. They were the only remnants of my manicure. About 20 minutes later, the secretary showed up with the keys and let me in.
What can I do for you?
She asked, once she was seated at her desk. I handed her a stack of papers I'd been holding.
I'm withdrawing.
Her eyes widened to impossible size.
But what? You can't.
I tapped the stack. I can. It's all filled out. Still gaping, she muttered something to me about waiting and then scurried out of the room. A few minutes later, she returned with Headmistress Kirova. Kirova had apparently been briefed and was looking at me very disapprovingly down her beak-like nose.
Miss Hathaway, what's the meaning of this?
I'm leaving, I said. Quitting, dropping out, whatever.
You can't do that,
she said. Well, obviously I can, since you guys keep withdrawal paperwork in the library. It's all filled out the way it needs to be. Her anger changed into something sadder and more anxious.
I know a lot has gone on lately. We're all having trouble adjusting, but that's no reason to make a hasty decision. If anything, we need you more than ever.
She was almost pleading. Hard to believe she'd wanted to expel me 6 months ago.
This wasn't hasty, I said. I thought a lot about it.
Let me at least get your mother so we can talk this out. She left for Europe 3 days ago. Not that it matters anyway. I pointed to the line on the top form that said, date of birth.
I'm 18 today. She can't do anything anymore. This is my choice.
Now, will you stamp the form, or are you actually going to try to restrain me? Pretty sure I could take you in a fight, Kirova. They stamped my packet, not happily. The secretary made a copy of the official paper that declared I was no longer a student at St. Vladimir's Academy. I'd need it to get out the main gate. It was a long walk from the front of the school, and the western sky was red as the sun slipped over the horizon. The weather had warmed up, even at night. Spring had finally come. It made for good walking weather, since I had a ways to go before I made it to the highway. From there, I'd hitchhike to Missoula. Hitchhiking wasn't safe, but the silver stake in my coat pocket made me feel pretty secure about anything I'd face. No one had taken it away from me after the raid, and it would work just as well against creepy humans as it did with Strigoi. I could just make out the gates when I sensed her. Lyssa. I stopped walking and turned toward a cluster of bud-covered trees. She was standing in them, perfectly still, and had managed to hide her thoughts so well that I hadn't realized she was practically right next to me. Her hair and eyes glowed in the sunset,
and she seemed too beautiful and too ethereal to be part of this dreary landscape.
"Hey,"
I said. "Hey." She wrapped her arms around herself, cold even in her coat. Maroi didn't have the same resistance to temperature changes that Dampier's did. What I found warm and spring-like was still chilly to her.
"I knew it," she said.
"Ever since that day they said his body was gone, something told me you'd do this. I was just waiting."
"Can you read my mind now?" I asked, ruefully.
"No, I can just read you, finally. I can't believe how blind I was. I can't believe I never noticed. Victor's comment. He was right."
She glanced off at the sunset, then turned her gaze back on me. A flash of anger, both in her feelings and her eyes, hit me.
"Why didn't you tell me?" she cried. "Why didn't you tell me you loved Dmitri?"
I stared. I couldn't remember the last time Lyssa had yelled at anyone. Maybe last fall, when all the Victor insanity had gone down? Loud outbursts were my thing, not hers. Even when torturing Jesse, her voice had been deadly quiet.
"I couldn't tell anyone," I said.
"I'm your best friend, Rose. We've been through everything together. Do you really think I would have told? I would have kept it a secret?" I looked at the ground. "I know you would have. I don't know. I couldn't talk about it. Not even to you. I can't explain it."
"How?"
She groped for the question her mind had already formed.
"How serious was it? Was it just you, or?"
"It was both of us," I told her. "He felt the same, but we knew we couldn't be together. Not with our age and, well, not when we were supposed to be protecting you." Lyssa frowned.
"What do you mean?"
"Dmitri always said that if we were involved, we'd worry more about protecting each other than you. We couldn't do that." Guilt coursed through her at the thought that she'd been responsible for keeping us apart. "It's not your fault," I said quickly.
"Surely. There must have been a way. It wouldn't have been a problem."
I shrugged, unwilling to think about or mention our last kiss in the forest, back when Dmitri and I had thought we'd figure out a solution to all of our problems.
"I don't know," I said. "We just tried to stay apart. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't."
Her mind was a tumble of emotions. She felt sorry for me, but at the same time she was mad.
"You should have told me," she repeated. "I feel like you don't trust me."
"Of course I trust you. Is that why you're sneaking off?"
"That has nothing to do with trust," I admitted.
"It's me. Well, I didn't want to tell you. I couldn't bear to tell you I was leaving, or explain why."
"I already know," she said. "I figured it out."
"How?" I asked. Lyssa was full of surprises today.
"I was there, last fall when we took that van into Missoula, the shopping trip. You and Dmitri were talking about Strigoi, about how becoming one makes you something twisted and evil, how it destroys the person you used to be and makes you do horrible things. And I heard..."
She had trouble saying it. I had trouble hearing it. And my eyes grew wet. The memory was too harsh. Thinking of sitting with him that day, back when we were first falling in love.
Lyssa swallowed and continued. "I heard you both say you'd rather die than become a monster like that."
Silence fell between us. The wind picked up and blew our hair around, dark and light. "I have to do this, Lys. I have to do it for him."
"No," she said firmly. "You don't have to. You didn't promise him anything."
"Not in words, no. But you...
you don't understand.
I understand that you're trying to cope, and that this is as good a way as any. You need to find another way to let him go."
I shook my head. "I have to do this.
Even if it means leaving me?"
The way she said it, the way she looked at me.
God, a flood of memories flitted through my mind. We'd been together since childhood, inseparable, bound, and yet Dmitri and I had been connected too. Damn it, I'd never wanted to have to choose between them.
I have to do this, I said yet again. I'm sorry.
You're supposed to be my guardian and go with me to college, she argued. You're shadow-kissed. We're supposed to be together. If you leave me...
The ugly coil of darkness was starting to raise its head in my chest. My voice was tight when I spoke. If I leave you, they'll get you another guardian. Two of them. You're the last Dragomir. They'll keep you safe.
But they won't be you, Rose, she said. Those luminous green eyes held mine, and the anger in me cooled. She was so beautiful, so sweet, and she seemed so reasonable. She was right. I owed it to her. I needed to...
Stop it! I yelled, turning away. She'd been using her magic. Do not use compulsion on me. You're my friend. Friends don't use their powers on each other.
Friends don't abandon each other, she snapped back. If you were my friend, you wouldn't do it.
I spun back toward her, careful not to look too closely into her eyes, in case she tried compulsion on me again. The rage in me exploded.
It's not about you, okay? This time it's about me, not you.
All my life, Lyssa, all my life it's been the same. They come first. I've lived my life for you. I've trained to be your shadow. But you know what? I want to come first. I need to take care of myself for once. I'm tired of looking out for everyone else and having to put aside what I want. Dimitri and I did that, and look what happened. He's gone. I will never hold him again. Now I owe it to him to do this. I'm sorry if it hurts you, but it's my choice.
I'd shouted the words, not even pausing for a breath, and I hoped my voice hadn't carried to the guardians on duty at the gate. Lyssa was staring at me, shocked and hurt. Tears ran down her cheeks, and part of me shriveled up at hurting the person I'd sworn to protect.
You love him more than me, she said in a small voice, sounding very young.
He needs me right now.
I need you. He's gone, Rose.
No, I said. But he will be soon. I reached up my sleeve and took off the tchotchke she'd given me for Christmas. I held it out to her. She hesitated and then took it.
What's this for? She asked.
I can't wear it. It's for a Dragomir guardian. I'll take it again when I... I had almost said if, not when. I think she knew that. When I get back.
Her hands closed around the beads.
Please, Rose, please don't leave me.
I'm sorry, I said. There were no other words to offer up.
I'm sorry.
I left her there crying as I walked toward the gate. A piece of my soul had died when Dimitri had fallen. Turning my back on her now, I felt another piece die as well. Soon there wouldn't be anything left inside of me. The guardians at the gate were as shocked as the secretary and Kirova had been, but there was nothing they could do. Happy birthday to me, I thought bitterly. 18 at last. It was nothing like I had expected. They opened the gates, and I stepped through, outside of the school's grounds and over the wards. The lines were invisible, but I felt strangely vulnerable and exposed, as if I'd leapt a great chasm. And yet, at the same time, I felt free and in control. I started walking down the narrow road. The sun was nearly gone. I'd have to rely on moonlight soon. When I was out of earshot of the guardians, I stopped and spoke. Mason. I had to wait a long time. When he appeared, I could barely see him at all. He was almost completely transparent.
It's time, isn't it? You're going. You're finally moving on to...
Well, I had no clue where he was moving on to. I didn't know anymore what lay beyond, whether it was the realms Father Andrew believed in, or some entirely different world that I'd visited. Nonetheless, Mason understood and nodded. It's been more than 40 days, I mused. So I guess you're overdue. I'm glad. I mean, I hope you find peace. Although I kind of hoped you'd be able to lead me to him. Mason shook his head, and he didn't need to say a word for me to understand what he wanted to tell me.
You're on your own now, Rose.
It's okay. You deserve your rest. Besides, I think I know where to start looking. I've thought about this constantly over the last week. If Dimitri was where I believed he was, I had a lot of work ahead of me. Mason's help would have been nice, but I didn't want to keep bothering him. It seemed like he had enough to deal with. Goodbye, I told him. Thanks for your help. I'll miss you. His form grew fainter and fainter, and just before it went all together, I saw the hint of a smile. That laughing and mischievous smile I'd loved so much. For the first time since his death, thinking about Mason no longer devastated me. I was sad, and I really would miss him. But I knew he'd moved on to something good. Something really good. I no longer felt guilty. Turning away, I stared at the long road winding off ahead of me. I sighed. This trip might take a while. Then start walking, Rose, I muttered to myself. I set off, off to kill the man I loved.
This has been an Audible.com and Penguin Young Readers Group production. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2008 by Rochelle Mead. Audio recording copyright 2008 by Penguin Group USA Incorporated.
Penguin Audio presents Spiritbound, a Vampire Academy novel by Rochelle Mead. Read by Emily Schaefer. Chapter 1. There's a big difference between death threats and love letters, even if the person writing the death threats still claims to actually love you. Of course, considering I once tried to kill someone I loved, maybe I had no right to judge. Today's letter had been perfectly timed, not that I should have expected any less. I'd read it 4 times so far, and even though I was running late, I couldn't help but read it a 5th time. My dearest Rose, one of the few downsides to being awakened is that we no longer require sleep. Therefore, we also no longer dream. It's a shame, because if I could dream, I know I'd dream about you. I dream about the way you smell and how your dark hair feels like silk between my fingers. I dream about the smoothness of your skin and the fierceness of your lips when we kiss. Without dreams, I have to be content with my own imagination, which is almost as good. I can picture all of those things perfectly, as well as how it'll be when I take your life from this world. It's something I regret having to do, but you've made my choice inevitable. Your refusal to join me in eternal life and love leaves no other course of action, and I can't allow someone as dangerous as you to live. Besides, even if I forced your awakening, you now have so many enemies among the Strigoi that one of them would kill you. If you must die, it'll be by my hand, no one else's. Nonetheless, I wish you well today as you take your trials. Not that you need any luck. If they're actually making you take them, it's a waste of everyone's time. You're the best in that group, and by this evening, you'll wear your promise mark. Of course, that means you'll be all that much more of a challenge when we meet again, which I'll definitely enjoy. And we will be meeting again. With graduation, you'll be turned out of the academy, and once you're outside the wards, I'll find you. There is no place in this world you can hide from me. I'm watching. Love, Dimitri. Despite his warm wishes, I didn't really find the letter inspiring as I tossed it onto my bed and blearily left the room. I tried not to let his words get to me, though it was kind of impossible to not be creeped out by something like that. There is no place in this world you can hide from me. I didn't doubt it. I knew Dimitri had spies, since my former instructor-turned-lover had been turned into an evil, undead vampire. He'd also become a sort of leader among them, something I'd helped speed along when I killed off his former boss. I suspected a lot of his spies were humans, watching for me to step outside my school's borders. Nostrogoi could have stayed on a 24-hour stakeout. Humans could, and I'd recently learned that plenty of humans were willing to serve the Strigoi in exchange for the promise of being turned someday. Those humans considered eternal life worth corrupting their souls and killing off others to survive. Those humans made me sick. But the humans weren't what made my steps falter as I walked through grass that had turned bright green with summer's touch. It was Dimitri. Always Dimitri. Dimitri, the man I'd loved. Dimitri, the Strigoi I wanted to save. Dimitri, the monster I'd most likely have to kill. The love we'd shared always burned within me, no matter how often I told myself to move on, no matter how much the world did think I'd moved on. He was always with me, always on my mind, always making me question myself.
You look like you're ready to face an army.
I shifted out of my dark thoughts. I'd been so fixated on Dimitri and his letter that I'd been walking across campus, oblivious to the world, and hadn't noticed my best friend Lyssa falling into step with me, a teasing smile on her face. Her catching me by surprise was a rarity because we shared a psychic bond, one that always kept me aware of her presence and feelings. I had to be pretty distracted to not notice her, and if ever there was a distraction, it was someone wanting to kill me. I gave Lyssa what I hoped was a convincing smile. She knew what had happened to Dimitri, and how he was waiting to kill me after I'd tried, and failed, to kill him. Nonetheless, the letters I got from him every week worried her, and she had enough to deal with in her life without my undead stalker to add to the list. I kind of am facing an army, I pointed out. It was early evening, but late summer still found the sun up in the Montana sky, bathing us in golden light as we walked. I loved it, but as a Moroi, a peaceful living vampire, Lyssa would eventually grow weak and uncomfortable in it. She laughed and tossed her platinum hair over one shoulder. The sun lit up the pale color into angelic brilliance. I suppose. I didn't think you'd really be all that worried. I could understand her reasoning. Even Dimitri had said these would be a waste of my time. After all, I'd gone to Russia to search for him and had faced real Strigoi, killing a number of them on my own. Maybe I shouldn't have been afraid of the upcoming tests, but all the fanfare and expectations suddenly pressed in upon me. My heart rate increased. What if I couldn't do it? What if I wasn't as good as I thought I was? The guardians who would challenge me out here might not be true Strigoi, but they were skilled and had been fighting a lot longer than me. Arrogance could get me into a lot of trouble, and if I failed, I'd be doing it in front of all the people who cared about me, all the people who had such faith in me. One other thing also concerned me. I'm worried about how these grades will affect my future, I said. That was the truth. The trials were the final exam for a novice guardian like me. They ensured I could graduate from St. Vladimir's Academy and take my place with true guardians who defended Moroi from the Strigoi. The trials pretty much decided which Moroi a guardian would be assigned to. Through our bond, I felt Lyssa's compassion and her worry.
Alberta thinks there's a good chance we can stay together, that you'll still be my guardian.
I grimaced. I think Alberta was saying that to keep me in school. I dropped out to hunt Dimitri a few months ago and then returned, something that didn't look good on my academic record. There was also the small fact that the Moroi queen, Tatiana,
hated me and would probably be going out of her way to influence my assignment, but that was another story. I think Alberta knows the only way they'd let me protect you is if I was the last guardian on Earth. And even then, my odds would still be pretty slim. Ahead of us, the roar of a crowd grew loud. One of the school's many sports fields had been transformed into an arena on par with something from Roman gladiatorial days. The bleachers had been built up, expanded from simple wooden seats to luxuriously cushioned benches with awnings to shade the Moroi from the sun. Banners surrounded the field, their bright colors visible from here as they whipped in the wind. I couldn't see them yet, but I knew there would be some type of barracks built near the stadium's entrance where novices waited, nerves on edge. The field itself would have turned into an obstacle course of dangerous tests, and from the sound of those deafening cheers, plenty were already there to witness this event. "I'm not giving up hope," Lissa said. Through the bond, I knew she meant it. It was one of the wonderful things about her. A steadfast faith and optimism that weathered the most terrible ordeals. It was a sharp contrast to my recent cynicism. "And I've got something that might help you out today." She came to a stop and reached into her jeans pocket, producing a small silver ring scattered with tiny stones that looked like peridots. I didn't need any bond to understand what she was offering. "Oh, Liss, I don't know. I don't want any, unfair advantage." Lissa rolled her eyes. "That's not the problem, and you know it. This one's fine, I swear." The ring she offered me was a charm, infused with the rare type of magic she wielded. All Moroi had control of one of five elements: earth, air, water, fire, or spirit. Spirit was the rarest, so rare it had been forgotten over the centuries. Then Lissa and a few others had recently surfaced with it. Unlike the other elements, which were more physical in nature, spirit was tied into the mind and all sorts of psychic phenomena. No one fully understood it. Making charms with spirit was something Lissa had recently begun to experiment with, and she wasn't very good at it. Her best spirit ability was healing, so she kept trying to make healing charms. The last one had been a bracelet that singed my arm. "This one works. Only a little, but it'll help keep the darkness away during the trial." She spoke lightly, but we both knew the seriousness of her words. With all of spirit's gifts came a cost, a darkness that showed itself now as anger and confusion, and eventually led to insanity. Darkness that sometimes bled over into me through our bond. Lissa and I had been told that with charms and her healing, we could fight it off. That was also something we had yet to master. I gave her a faint smile, moved by her concern, and accepted the ring. It didn't scald my hand, which I took as a promising sign. It was tiny and only fit on my pinky. I felt nothing whatsoever as it slid on. Sometimes that happened with healing charms. Or it could mean the ring was completely ineffectual. Either way, no harm done. "Thanks," I said. I felt delight sweep through her, and we continued walking. I held my hand out before me, admiring the way the green stones glittered. Jewelry wasn't a great idea in the kind of physical ordeals I'd be facing, but I would have gloves on to cover it. "Hard to believe that after this, we'll be done here and out in the real world," I mused aloud, not really considering my words. Beside me, Lissa stiffened, and I immediately regretted speaking. Being out in the real world meant Lissa and I were going to undertake a task she'd, unhappily, promised to help me with a couple months ago. While in Siberia, I learned there might be a way to restore Dimitri back to being a Dampir like me. It was a long shot, possibly a lie, and considering the way he was fixated on killing me, I had no illusions that I would have any other choice but to kill him if it came down to him or me. But if there was a way I might save him before that happened, I had to find out. Unfortunately, the only lead we had to making this miracle come true was through a criminal. Not just any criminal, either. Viktor Dashkov, a royal Moroi who had tortured Lissa and committed all sorts of other atrocities that had made our lives hell. Justice had been served, and Viktor was locked away in prison, which complicated things. We'd learned that so long as he was destined for a life behind bars, he saw no reason to share what he knew about his half-brother, the only person who had once allegedly saved Ostrogoi. I decided, possibly illogically, that Victor might give up the information if we offered him the one thing no one else could. Freedom. This idea was not foolproof, for a number of reasons. First, I didn't know if it would work. That was kind of a big thing. Second, I had no idea how to stage a prison break, let alone where his prison even was. And finally, there was the fact that we would be releasing our mortal enemy. That was devastating enough to me, let alone Lyssa. Yet as much as the idea troubled her, and believe me, it did, she'd firmly sworn she would help me. I'd offered to free her from the promise dozens of times in the last couple months, but she'd stood firm. Of course, considering we had no way to even find the prison, her promise might not matter in the end. I tried to fill the awkward silence between us, explaining instead that I'd really meant we'd be able to celebrate her birthday in style next week. My attempts were interrupted by Stan, one of my longtime instructors.
Hathaway,
he barked, coming from the direction of the field.
Nice of you to join us. Get in there now.
Thoughts of Victor vanished from Lyssa's mind. Lyssa gave me a quick hug.
Good luck, she whispered. Not that you need it.
Stan's expression told me that this 10-second goodbye was 10 seconds too long. I gave Lyssa a grin by way of thanks, and then she headed off to find our friends in the stands while I scurried after Stan.
You're lucky you aren't one of the first ones, he growled. People were even making bets about whether you'd show.
Really? I asked cheerfully. What kind of odds are there on that? Because I can still change my mind and put down my own bet. Make a little pocket money. His narrowed eyes shot me a warning that needed no words as we entered the waiting area adjacent to the field across from the stands. It had always amazed me in past years how much work went into these trials, and I was no less impressed now as I saw it up close. The barrack that novices waited in was constructed out of wood, complete with a roof. The structure looked as though it had been part of the stadium forever. It had been built with remarkable speed and would be taken down equally quickly once the trials were over. A doorway about 3 people wide gave a partial glimpse onto the field, where one of my classmates was waiting anxiously for her name to be called. All sorts of obstacles were set up there. Challenges to test balance and coordination while still having to battle and elude the adult guardians who would be lurking around objects in corners. Wooden walls had been constructed on one end of the field, creating a dark and confusing maze. Nets and shaky platforms hung across other areas, designed to test just how well we could fight under difficult conditions. A few of the other novices crowded the doorway, hoping to get an advantage by watching those who went ahead of them. Not me. I would go in there blind, content to take on whatever they threw before me. Studying the course now would simply make me overthink and panic. Calm was what I needed now. So I leaned against one of the barrack walls and watched those around me. It appeared that I really had been the last to show up, and I wondered if people had actually lost money betting on me. Some of my classmates whispered in clusters. Some were doing stretches and warm-up exercises. Others stood with instructors who had been mentors. Those teachers spoke intently to their students, giving last-minute words of advice. I kept hearing words like focus and calm down. Seeing the instructors made my heart clench. Not so long ago, that was how I'd pictured this day. I'd imagined Dimitri and me standing together, with him telling me to take this seriously and not to lose my cool when I was out on the field. Alberta had done a fair amount of mentoring for me since I'd returned from Russia, but as captain, she was out on the field herself now, busy with all sorts of responsibilities. She had no time to come in here and hold my hand. Friends of mine who might have offered comfort, Eddie, Meredith, and others, were wrapped up in their own fears. I was alone. Without her or Dimitri, or, well, anyone, I felt a surprising ache of loneliness flow through me. This wasn't right. I shouldn't have been alone. Dimitri should have been here with me. That's how it was supposed to have been. Closing my eyes, I allowed myself to pretend he was really there, only inches away as we spoke.
Don't worry, comrade. I can do this blindfolded. Hell, maybe I actually will.
Do you have anything I can use?
If you're nice to me, I'll even let you tie it on.
Since this fantasy would have taken place after we'd slept together, there was a strong possibility that he would have later helped me take off that blindfold, among other things. I could perfectly picture the exasperated shake of his head that would earn me.
Gross. I swear. Sometimes it feels like every day with you is my own personal trial.
But I knew he'd smile anyway, and the look of pride and encouragement he'd give me as I headed toward the field would be all I needed to get through the tests.
Are you meditating?
I opened my eyes, astonished at the voice.
Mom? What are you doing here?
My mother, Janine Hathaway, stood in front of me. She was just a few inches shorter than me, but had enough fight in her for someone twice my size. The dangerous look on her tanned face dared anyone to bring on a challenge. She gave me a wry smile and put one hand on her hip.
Did you honestly think I wouldn't come to watch you?
I don't know, I admitted, feeling kind of guilty for doubting her. She and I hadn't had much contact over the years, and it was only recent events, most of them bad, that had begun to reestablish our connection. Most of the time, I still didn't know how to feel about her. I oscillated between a little girl's need for her absent mother and a teenager's resentment over abandonment. I also wasn't entirely sure if I'd forgiven her for the time she, accidentally, punched me in a mock fight. I figured you'd have, you know, more important things to do.
There's no way I could miss this.
She inclined her head toward the stands, making her auburn curls sway.
Neither could your father.
What? I hurried toward the doorway and peered out onto the fields. My view of the stands wasn't fantastic, thanks to all the obstacles on the field, but it was good enough. There he was, Abe Mazur. He was easy to spot, with his black beard and mustache, as well as the emerald green scarf knotted over his dress shirt. I could even barely make out the glint of his gold earring. He had to be melting in this heat, but I figured it would take more than a little sweat for him to tame down his flashy fashion sense. If my relationship with my mother was sketchy, my relationship with my father was practically non-existent. I'd met him back in May, and even then, it wasn't until after I'd gotten back that I found out I was his daughter. All Dom Pierce had one Maroi parent, and he was mine. I still wasn't sure how I felt about him. Most of his background remained a mystery, but there were plenty of rumors that he was involved with illegal business. People also acted like he was the kneecap-breaking type, and though I'd seen little evidence of this, I didn't find it surprising. In Russia, they called him Zmei, the serpent. While I stared at him in astonishment, my mom strolled over to my side.
"He'll be happy you made it in time," she said. "He's running some big wager on whether you'd show. He put his money on you, if that makes you feel any better."
I groaned. Of course. Of course he'd be the bookie behind the pool. I should have known as soon as... My jaw dropped.
"Is he talking to Adrian?"
"Yup." Sitting beside Abe was Adrian Ivashkov, my more or less boyfriend. Adrian was a Royal Maroi and another spirit user like Lissa. He'd been crazy about me, and often just crazy, ever since we first met, but I'd had eyes only for Dmitri. After the failure in Russia, I'd returned and promised to give Adrian a shot. To my surprise, things had been good between us. Great, even. He'd written me up a proposal of why dating him was a sound decision. It had included things like, "I'll give up cigarettes unless I really, really need one," and "I'll unleash romantic surprises every week, such as an impromptu picnic, roses, or a trip to Paris," but not actually any of those things because now they're not surprises. Being with him wasn't like it had been with Dmitri, but then I supposed no two relationships could ever be exactly alike. They were different men, after all. I still woke up all the time aching over the loss of Dmitri and our love. I tormented myself over my failure to kill him in Siberia and free him from his undead state. Still,
that despair didn't mean my romantic life was over. Something it had taken me a while to accept. Moving on was hard, but Adrian did make me happy. And for now, that was enough. But that didn't necessarily mean I wanted him cozying up to my pirate mobster father either. "He's a bad influence," I protested. My mother snorted. "I doubt Adrian will influence Abe that much." "Not Adrian, Abe!" "Adrian's trying to be on good behavior. Abe will mess everything up." Along with smoking, Adrian had sworn he'd quit drinking and other vices in his dating proposal. I squinted at him and Abe across the crowded stands, trying to figure out what topic could be so interesting. "What are they talking about?" "I think that's the least of your problems right now." Janine Hathaway was nothing if not practical. "Worry less about them and more about that field."
"Do you think they're talking about me?"
"Rose!" My mother gave me a light punch on the arm, and I dragged my eyes back to her. "You have to take this seriously. Keep calm and don't get distracted." Her words were so like what I'd imagined Dimitri saying that a small smile crept onto my face. I wasn't alone out here after all.
"What's so funny?" she asked warily.
"Nothing," I said, giving her a hug. She was stiff at first, and then relaxed, actually hugging me back briefly before stepping away. "I'm glad you're here." My mother wasn't the overly affectionate type, and I'd caught her off guard.
"Well," she said, obviously flustered. "I told you I wouldn't miss this."
I glanced back at the stands.
"Abe, on the other hand, I'm not so sure of."
Or, wait, an odd idea came to me. No, not so odd, actually. Shady or not, Abe had connections, ones extensive enough to slip a message to Victor Dashkov in prison. Abe had been the one to ask for info about Robert Derue, Victor's spirit-wielding brother, as a favor to me. When Victor had sent back the message saying he had no reason to help Abe with what he needed, I'd promptly written off my father's assistance and jumped to my prison break idea. But now...
"Rosemarie Hathaway!"
It was Alberta who called me, her voice ringing loud and clear. It was like a trumpet, a call to battle. All thoughts of Abe and Adrian, and yes, even Dimitri, vanished from my mind. I think my mother wished me good luck, but the exact wording was lost on me as I strode toward Alberta and the field. Adrenaline surged through me. All my attention was now on what laid ahead, the test that would finally make me a guardian. Chapter 2. My trials were a blur. You'd think, seeing as they were the most important part of my education at St. Vladimir's, that I'd remember everything in perfect, crystalline detail. Yet my earlier thoughts were kind of realized. How could these measure up to what I'd already faced? How could these mock fights compare to a mob of Strigoi descending on our school? I'd had to stand against overwhelming odds, not knowing if those I loved were alive or dead. And how could I fear a so-called battle with one of the school's instructors after having fought Dimitri? He'd been lethal as a Dampier, and worse as a Strigoi. Not that I meant to make light of the trials. They were serious. Novices failed them all the time, and I refused to be one of them. I was attacked on all sides by guardians who'd been fighting and defending Maroi since before I was born. The arena wasn't flat, which complicated everything. They'd filled it with contraptions and obstacles, beams and steps that tested my balance, including a bridge that painfully reminded me of that last night I'd seen Dimitri. I'd pushed him after plunging a silver stake into his heart, a stake that had fallen out during his plummet to the river below. The arena's bridge was a bit different from the solid wooden one upon which Dimitri and I had fought in Siberia. This one was rickety, a badly constructed path of wooden planks with only rope rails for support. Every step made the entire bridge swing and shake, and holes in the boards showed me where former classmates had, unfortunately for them, discovered weak spots. The test they assigned me on the bridge was probably the worst of all. My goal was to get a Maroi away from a group of Strigoi that were in pursuit. My Maroi was being played by Daniel, a new guardian who had come with others to the school to replace those killed in the attack. I didn't know him very well, but for this exercise, he was playing completely docile and helpless, even a little afraid, just as any Maroi I was guarding might have been. He gave me a little resistance about stepping onto the bridge, and I used my calmest, most coaxing voice to finally get him to walk out ahead of me. Apparently, they were testing people skills as well as combat skills. Not far behind us on the course, I knew the guardians acting as Trigoi were approaching. Daniel stepped out, and I shadowed him, still giving him reassurances while all my senses stayed on alert. The bridge swung wildly, telling me with a jolt that our pursuers had joined us. I glanced back and saw three Strigoi coming after us. The guardians playing them were doing a remarkable job, moving with as much dexterity and speed as true Strigoi would. They were going to overtake us if we didn't get a move on. "You're doing great," I told Daniel. It was hard to keep the right tone in my voice. Screaming at Maroi might put them into shock. Too much gentleness would make them think it wasn't serious. "And I know you can move faster. We need to keep ahead of them. They're getting closer. I know you can do this. Come on." I must have passed that persuasive part of the test because he did indeed pick up his speed. Not quite enough to match that of our pursuers, but it was a start. The bridge shifted crazily again. Daniel yelped convincingly and froze, gripping the rope's sides tightly. Ahead of him, I saw another guardian Astrogoi waiting on the opposite side of the bridge. I believed his name was Randall, another new instructor. I was sandwiched between him and the group at my back, but Randall stayed still, waiting on the first plank of the bridge so that he could shake it and make it harder for us. "Keep going," I urged, my mind spinning. "You can do it."
"But there's a Strigoi there. We're trapped,"
Daniel exclaimed.
"Don't worry. I'll deal with him. Just move."
My voice was fierce this time, and Daniel crept forward, pushed on by my command. The next few moments required perfect timing on my part. I had to watch the Strigoi on both sides of us and keep Daniel in motion, all the while monitoring where we were on the bridge. When we were almost three quarters of the way across, I hissed, "Drop down on all fours right now. Hurry." He obeyed, coming to a halt. I immediately knelt, still speaking in an undertone. "I'm about to shout at you. Ignore it." In a louder voice, for the benefit of those coming after us, I exclaimed,
"What are you doing? We can't stop."
Daniel didn't budge, and I again spoke softly. "Good. See where the ropes connect the base to the rails? Grab them. Grab them as tightly as you can, and do not let go, no matter what happens. Wrap them around your hands if you have to. Do it now." He obeyed. The clock was ticking, and I didn't waste another moment. In one motion, while still crouched, I turned around and hacked at the ropes with a knife I'd been given along with my stake. The blade was sharp, thank God. The guardians running the trial weren't messing around. It didn't instantly slice the ropes, but I cut through them so quickly that the Strigoi on either side of us didn't have time to react. The ropes snapped, just as I again reminded Daniel to hold on. The two halves of the bridge swung toward the sides of wooden scaffolding, carried by the weight of the people on them. Well, ours did at least. Daniel and I had been prepared. The three pursuers behind us hadn't been. Two fell. One just barely managed to catch hold of a plank, slipping a bit before securing his grip. The actual drop was 6 feet, but I'd been told to regard it as 50, a distance that would kill me and Daniel if we fell. Against all odds, he was still clutching the rope. I was hanging on as well, and once the rope and wood were lying flat against the scaffolding's sides, I began scrambling up it like a ladder. It wasn't easy climbing over Daniel, but I did it, giving me one more chance to tell him to hang on. Randall, who'd been waiting ahead of us, hadn't fallen off. He'd had his feet on the bridge when I cut it, though, and had been surprised enough to lose his balance. Quick to recover, he was now shimmying up the ropes, trying to climb up to the solid surface above. He was much closer to it than me, but I just managed to grab his leg and stop him. I jerked him toward me. He maintained his grip on the bridge and we struggled. I knew I probably couldn't pull him off, but I was able to keep getting closer. At last, I let go of the knife I'd been holding and managed to get the stake from my belt, something that tested my balance. Randall's ungainly position gave me a shot at his heart, and I took it. For the trials, we had blunt-ended stakes, ones that wouldn't pierce skin, but which could be used with enough force to convince our opponents that we knew what we were doing. My alignment was perfect, and Randall, conceding it would have been a killing blow.